These are not marginal organisms. Without fungi, there would be no potato blights, Dutch elm disease, jock itch, or athlete's foot, but also no yogurts or beers or cheeses. Altogether, about 70,000 species of fungi have been identified, but it is thought the number could be as high as 1.8 million. A lot of mycologists work in industry, making cheeses and yogurts and the like, so it's hard to say how many are actively involved in research. But we can safely take it that there are more species of fungi to be found than there are people to find them. The world is a really big place. We have been gulled by the ease of air travel and other forms of communication into thinking that the world is not all that big. But at ground level, where researchers must work, it is actually enormous. Enormous enough to be full of surprises. The okapi, the nearest living relative of the giraffe, is now known to exist in substantial numbers in the rainforests of Zaire. The total population is estimated at perhaps 30,000, yet its existence wasn't even suspected until the 20th century. The large, flightless New Zealand bird called the takahi had been presumed extinct for 200 years before being found living in a rugged area of the country's South Island. In 1995, a team of French and British scientists in Tibet, who were lost in a snowstorm in a remote valley, came across a breed of horse called the rewoche, that had previously been known only from prehistoric cave drawings. The valley's inhabitants were astonished to learn that the horse was considered a rarity in the wider world. Some people think even greater surprises may await us. A leading British ethnobiologist, wrote The Economist in 1995, thinks a megatherium, a sort of giant ground sloth, which may stand as high as a giraffe, may lurk in the fastnesses of the Amazon basin. Perhaps significantly, the ethnobiologist wasn't named. Perhaps even more significantly, nothing more has been heard of him or his giant sloth. No one, however, can categorically say that no such thing is there until every jungly glade has been investigated, and we are a long way from achieving that. But even if we groomed thousands of field workers and dispatched them to the farthest corners of the world, it would not be effort enough, for wherever life can be, it is. Life's extraordinary fecundity is amazing, even gratifying, but also problematic. To survey it all, you would have to turn over every rock, sift through the litter on every forest floor, sieve unimaginable quantities of sand and dirt, climb into every forest canopy, and devise much more efficient ways to examine the seas. Even then, you would overlook whole ecosystems. In the 1980s, spelunkers entered a deep cave in Romania that had been sealed off from the outside world for a long but unknown period, and found 33 species of insects and other small creatures, spiders, centipedes, lice, all blind, colourless, and new to science. They were living off the microbes in the surface scum of pools, which in turn were feeding on hydrogen sulfide from hot springs. Our instinct may be to see the impossibility of tracking everything down as frustrating, dispiriting, perhaps even appalling, but it can just as well be viewed as almost unbearably exciting. We live on a planet that has a more or less infinite capacity to surprise. What reasoning person could possibly want it any other way? What is nearly always most arresting in any ramble through the scattered disciplines of modern science is realizing how many people have been willing to devote lifetimes to the most sumptuously esoteric lines of inquiry. In one of his essays, Stephen Jay Gould notes how a hero of his named Henry Edward Crampton spent 50 years, from 1906 to his death in 1956, quietly studying a genus of land snails in Polynesia called Partula. Over and over, year after year, Crampton measured to the tiniest degree, to 8 decimal places, the whorls and arcs and gentle curves of numberless partula, compiling the results into fastidiously detailed tables. A single line of text in a Crampton table could represent weeks of measurement and calculation. Only slightly less devoted, and certainly more unexpected, was Alfred C. Kinsey, who became famous for his studies of human sexuality in the 1940s and 1950s. But before his mind became filled with sex, so to speak, Kinsey was an entomologist, and a dogged one at that. In one expedition lasting 2 years, he hiked 2,500 miles to assemble a collection of 300,000 wasps. How many stings he collected along the way is not, alas, recorded. Something that had been puzzling me was the question of how you assured a chain of succession in these arcane fields. Clearly, there cannot be many institutions in the world that require or are prepared to support specialists in barnacles or Pacific snails. As we parted at the Natural History Museum in London, I asked Richard Forte how science ensures that when one person goes, there's someone ready to take his place. He chuckled rather heartily at my naivete. I'm afraid it's not as if we have substitutes sitting on the bench somewhere, waiting to be called in to play. When a specialist retires, or, even more unfortunately, dies, that can bring a stop to things in that field, sometimes for a very long while. And I suppose that's why you value someone who spends 42 years studying a single species of plant, even if it doesn't produce anything terribly new. Precisely, he said. Precisely. And he really seemed to mean it. 24. Cells. It starts with a single cell. The first cell splits to become two, and the two become four, and so on. After just 47 doublings, you have 10,000 trillion cells in your body and are ready to spring forth as a human being. Actually, quite a lot of cells are lost in the process of development, so the number you emerge with is really just a guess. Depending on which source you consult, the number can vary by several orders of magnitude. The figure of 10,000 trillion, or quadrillion, is from Margulis and Sagan, 1986. And every one of those cells knows exactly what to do to preserve and nurture you from the moment of conception to your last breath. You have no secrets from your cells. They know far more about you than you do. Each one carries a copy of the complete genetic code, the instruction manual for your body, so it knows not only how to do its job, but every other job in the body. Never in your life will you have to remind a cell to keep an eye on its adenosine triphosphate levels, or to find a place for the extra squirt of folic acid that's just unexpectedly turned up. It will do that for you, and millions more things besides. Every cell in nature is a thing of wonder. Even the simplest are far beyond the limits of human ingenuity. To build the most basic yeast cell, for example, you would have to miniaturize about the same number of components as are found in a Boeing 777 jetliner, and fit them into a sphere just 5 microns across. Then, somehow, you would have to persuade that sphere to reproduce. But yeast cells are as nothing compared with human cells, which are not just more varied and complicated, but vastly more fascinating because of their complex interactions. Your cells are a country of 10,000 trillion citizens, each devoted in some intensively specific way to your overall well-being. There isn't a thing they don't do for you. They let you feel pleasure and form thoughts. They enable you to stand and stretch and caper. When you eat, they extract the nutrients, distribute the energy, and carry off the wastes, all those things you learned about in junior high school biology. But they also remember to make you hungry in the first place, and reward you with a feeling of well-being afterwards, so that you won't forget to eat again. They keep your hair growing, your ears waxed, your brain quietly purring. They manage every corner of your being. They will jump to your defense the instant you are threatened. They will unhesitatingly die for you. Billions of them do so daily. And not once in all your years have you thanked even one of them. So let us take a moment now to regard them with the wonder and appreciation they deserve. We understand a little of how cells do the things they do, how they lay down fat or manufacture insulin, or engage in many of the other acts necessary to maintain a complicated entity like yourself, but only a little. You have at least 200,000 different types of protein laboring away inside you, and so far we understand what no more than about 2% of them do. Others put the figure at more like 50%. It depends, apparently, on what you mean by understand. Surprises at the cellular level turn up all the time. In nature, nitric oxide is a formidable toxin and a common component of air pollution, so scientists were naturally a little surprised when, in the mid-1980s, they found it being produced in a curiously devoted manner in human cells. Its purpose was at first a mystery, But then scientists began to find it all over the place, controlling the flow of blood and the energy levels of cells, attacking cancers and other pathogens, regulating the sense of smell, even assisting in penile erections. It also explained why nitroglycerin, the well-known explosive, soothes the heart pain known as angina. It is converted into nitric oxide in the bloodstream, relaxing the muscle linings of vessels, allowing blood to flow more freely. In barely the space of a decade, this one gassy substance went from extraneous toxin to ubiquitous elixir. You possess some few hundred different types of cell, according to the Belgian biochemist Christian de Duve, and they vary enormously in size and shape, from nerve cells whose filaments can stretch to several feet, to tiny, disc-shaped red blood cells, to the rod-shaped photocells that help to give us vision. They also come in a sumptuously wide range of sizes, nowhere more strikingly than at the moment of conception, when a single beating sperm confronts an egg 85,000 times bigger than it, which rather puts the notion of male conquest into perspective. On average, however, a human cell is about 20 microns wide. That is about 0.02 millimeter, which is too small to be seen, but roomy enough to hold thousands of complicated structures like mitochondria, and millions upon millions of molecules. In the most literal way, cells also vary in liveliness. Your skin cells are all dead. It's a somewhat galling notion to reflect that every inch of your surface is deceased. If you are an average-sized adult, you are lugging around about 5 pounds of dead skin, of which several billion tiny fragments are sloughed off each day. Run a finger along a dusty shelf, and you are drawing a pattern very largely in old skin. Most living cells seldom last more than a month or so, but there are some notable exceptions. Liver cells can survive for years, though the components within them may be renewed every few days. Brain cells last as long as you do. You are issued 100 billion or so at birth, and that is all you are ever going to get. It has been estimated that you lose 500 of them an hour. So if you have any serious thinking to do, there really isn't a moment to waste. The good news is that the individual components of your brain cells are constantly renewed, so that, as with liver cells, no part of them is actually likely to be more than about a month old. Indeed, it has been suggested that there isn't a single bit of any of us, not so much as a stray molecule, that was part of us 9 years ago. It may not feel like it, but at the cellular level, we are all youngsters. The first person to describe a cell was Robert Hooke, whom we last encountered squabbling with Isaac Newton over credit for the invention of the inverse square law. Hooke achieved many things in his 68 years. He was both an accomplished theoretician and a dab hand at making ingenious and useful instruments, but nothing he did brought him greater admiration than his popular book, Microphagia, or Some Physiological Descriptions of Miniature Bodies Made by Magnifying Glasses, produced in 1665. It revealed to an enchanted public a universe of the very small that was far more diverse, crowded, and finely structured than anyone had ever come close to imagining. Among the microscopic features first identified by Hooke were little chambers in plants that he called cells, because they reminded him of monks' cells. Hooke calculated that a 1-inch square of cork would contain 1,259,712,000 of these tiny chambers, the first appearance of such a very large number anywhere in science. Microscopes by this time had been around for a generation or so, but what set Hooke's apart were their technical supremacy. They achieved magnifications of 30 times, making them the last word in 17th century optical technology. So it came as something of a shock when just a decade later Hooke and the other members of London's Royal Society began to receive drawings and reports from an unlettered linen draper in Holland employing magnifications of up to 275 times. The draper's name was Antony van Leeuwenhoek. Though he had little formal education and no background in science, he was a perceptive and dedicated observer, and a technical genius. To this day it is not known how he got such magnificent magnifications from simple handheld devices, which were little more than modest wooden dowels with a tiny bubble of glass embedded in them, far more like magnifying glasses than what most of us think of as microscopes, but really not much like either. Leeuwenhoek made a new instrument for every experiment he performed, and was extremely secretive about his techniques, though he did sometimes offer tips to the British on how they might improve their resolutions. Leeuwenhoek was close friends with another Delft notable, the artist Jan Vermeer. In the mid-1660s, Vermeer, who previously had been a competent but not outstanding artist, suddenly developed the mastery of light and perspective for which he has been celebrated ever since. Though it has never been proved, it has long been suspected that he used a camera obscura, a device for projecting images onto a flat surface through a lens. No such device was listed among Vermeer's personal effects after his death, but it happens that the executor of Vermeer's estate was none other than Antony van Leeuwenhoek, the most secretive lens-maker of his day. Over a period of 50 years, beginning remarkably enough when he was already past 40, Leeuwenhoek made almost 200 reports to the Royal Society, all written in Low Dutch, the only tongue of which he was master. He offered no interpretations, but simply the facts of what he had found, accompanied by exquisite drawings. He sent reports on almost everything that could be usefully examined: bread mould, a bee's stinger, blood cells, teeth, hair, his own saliva, excrement, and semen, these last with fretful apologies for their unsavoury nature, nearly all of which had never been seen microscopically before. After he reported finding animalcules in a sample of pepper water in 1676, the members of the Royal Society spent a year with the best devices English technology could produce, searching for the little animals, before finally getting the magnification right. What Leeuwenhoek had found were protozoa. He calculated that there were 8,280,000 of these tiny beings in a single drop of water, more than the number of people in Holland. The world teemed with life in ways and numbers that no one had previously suspected. Inspired by Leeuwenhoek's fantastic findings, others began to peer into microscopes with such keenness that they sometimes found things that weren't in fact there. One respected Dutch observer, Nicolaus Hartsicker, was convinced he saw tiny preformed men in sperm cells. He called the little beings homunculi, and for some time many people believed that all humans, indeed all creatures, were simply vastly inflated versions of tiny but complete precursor beings. Leeuwenhoek himself occasionally got carried away with his enthusiasms. In one of his least successful experiments, he tried to study the explosive properties of gunpowder by observing a small blast at close range. He nearly blinded himself in the process. In 1683, Leeuwenhoek discovered bacteria, but that was about as far as progress could get for the next century and a half because of the limitations of microscope technology. Not until 1831 would anyone first see the nucleus of a cell. It was found by the Scottish botanist Robert Brown, that frequent but always shadowy visitor to the history of science. Brown, who lived from 1773 to 1858, called it nucleus from the Latin nucula, meaning little nut or kernel. Not until 1839, however, did anyone realize that all living matter is cellular. It was Theodor Schwann, a German, who had this insight, and it was not only comparatively late, as scientific insights go, but not widely embraced at first. It wasn't until the 1860s and some landmark work by Louis Pasteur in France that it was shown conclusively that life cannot arise spontaneously, but must come from pre-existing cells. The belief became known as the cell theory, and it is the basis of all modern biology. The cell has been compared to many things, from a complex chemical refinery, by the physicist James Treffel, to a vast teeming metropolis, the biochemist Guy Brown. A cell is both of those things, and neither. It is like a refinery in that it is devoted to chemical activity on a grand scale, and like a metropolis in that it is crowded and busy and filled with interactions that seem confused and random, but clearly have some system to them. But it is a much more nightmarish place than any city or factory that you have ever seen. To begin with, there is no up or down inside the cell. Gravity doesn't meaningfully apply at the cellular scale, and not an atom's width of space is unused. There is activity everywhere, and a ceaseless thrum of electrical energy. You may not feel terribly electrical, but you are. The food we eat and the oxygen we breathe are combined in the cells into electricity. The reason we don't give each other massive shocks or scorch the sofa when we sit is that it is all happening on a tiny scale, a mere 0.1 volts travelling distances measured in nanometers. However, scale that up, and it would translate as a jolt of 20 million volts per meter, about the same as the charge carried by the main body of a thunderstorm. Whatever their size or shape, nearly all your cells are built to fundamentally the same plan. They have an outer casing, or membrane, a nucleus wherein resides the necessary genetic information to keep you going, and a busy space between the two called the cytoplasm. The membrane is not, as most of us imagine it, a durable rubbery casing, something that you would need a sharp pin to prick. Rather, it is made up of a type of fatty material known as a lipid, which has the approximate consistency of a light grade of machine oil, to quote Sherwin B. Newland. If that seems surprisingly insubstantial, bear in mind that at the microscopic level, things behave differently. To anything on a molecular scale, water becomes a kind of heavy-duty gel, and a lipid is like iron. If you could visit a cell, you wouldn't like it. Blown up to a scale at which atoms were about the size of peas, a cell itself would be a sphere roughly half a mile across, and supported by a complex framework of girders called the cytoskeleton. Within it, millions upon millions of objects, some the size of basketballs, others the size of cars, would whiz about like bullets. There wouldn't be a place you could stand without being pummeled and ripped thousands of times every second from every direction. Even for its full-time occupants, the inside of a cell is a hazardous place. Each strand of DNA is on average attacked or damaged once every 8.4 seconds, 10,000 times in a day, by chemicals and other agents that whack into or carelessly slice through it, and each of these wounds must be swiftly stitched up if the cell is not to perish. The proteins are especially lively, spinning, pulsating, and flying into each other up to a billion times a second. Enzymes, themselves a type of protein, dash everywhere, performing up to 1,000 tasks a second. Like greatly speeded-up worker ants, they busily build and rebuild molecules, hauling a piece off this one, adding a piece to that one. Some monitor passing proteins and mark with a chemical those that are irreparably damaged or flawed. Once so selected, the doomed proteins proceed to a structure called a proteasome, where they are stripped down and their components used to build new proteins. Some types of protein exist for less than half an hour, others survive for weeks, but all lead existences that are inconceivably frenzied. As de Duve notes, the molecular world must necessarily remain entirely beyond the powers of our imagination, owing to the incredible speed with which things happen in it. But slow things down, to a speed at which the interactions can be observed, and things don't seem quite so unnerving. You can see that a cell is just millions of objects. Lysosomes, endosomes, ribosomes, ligands, peroxisomes, proteins of every size and shape, bumping into millions of other objects and performing mundane tasks. Extracting energy from nutrients, assembling structures, getting rid of waste, warding off intruders, sending and receiving messages, making repairs. Typically, a cell will contain some 20,000 different types of protein, and of these about 2,000 types will each be represented by at least 50,000 molecules. This means, says Newland, that even if we count only those molecules present in amounts of more than 50,000 each, the total is still a very minimum of 100 million protein molecules in each cell. Such a staggering figure gives some idea of the swarming immensity of biochemical activity within us. It is all an immensely demanding process. Your heart must pump 75 gallons of blood an hour, 1,800 gallons every day, 657,000 gallons in a year. That's enough to fill four Olympic-sized swimming pools, to keep all those cells freshly oxygenated. And that's at rest. During exercise, the rate can increase as much as sixfold. The oxygen is taken up by the mitochondria. These are the cell's power stations, and there are about 1,000 of them in a typical cell, though the number varies considerably depending on what a cell does and how much energy it requires. You may recall from an earlier chapter that the mitochondria are thought to have originated as captive bacteria, and that they now live essentially as lodgers in our cells, preserving their own genetic instructions, dividing to their own timetable, speaking their own language. You may also recall that we are at the mercy of their goodwill. Here's why. Virtually all the food and oxygen you take into your body are delivered, after processing, to the mitochondria, where they are converted into a molecule called adenosine triphosphate, or ATP. You may not have heard of ATP, but it is what keeps you going. ATP molecules are essentially little battery packs that move through the cell, providing energy for all the cell's processes, and you get through a lot of it. At any given moment, a typical cell in your body will have about 1 billion ATP molecules in it, and in 2 minutes, every one of them will have been drained dry, and another billion will have taken their place. Every day you produce and use up a volume of ATP equivalent to about half your body weight. Feel the warmth of your skin. That's your ATP at work. When cells are no longer needed, they die with what can only be called great dignity. They take down all the struts and buttresses that hold them together and quietly devour their component parts. The process is known as apoptosis, or programmed cell death. Every day, billions of your cells die for your benefit, and billions of others clean up the mess. Cells can also die violently, for instance, when infected, but mostly they die because they are told to. Indeed, if not told to live, if not given some kind of active instruction from another cell, cells automatically kill themselves. Cells need a lot of reassurance. When, as occasionally happens, a cell fails to expire in the prescribed manner, but rather begins to divide and proliferate wildly, we call the result cancer. Cancer cells are really just confused cells. Cells make this mistake fairly regularly, but the body has elaborate mechanisms for dealing with it. It is only very rarely that the process spirals out of control. On average, humans suffer one fatal malignancy for each 100 million billion cell divisions. Cancer is bad luck in every possible sense of the term. The wonder of cells is not that things occasionally go wrong, but that they manage everything so smoothly for decades at a stretch. They do so by constantly sending and monitoring streams of messages, a cacophony of messages from all around the body. Instructions, queries, corrections, requests for assistance, updates, notices to divide or expire. Most of these signals arrive by means of couriers called hormones, chemical entities such as insulin, adrenaline, estrogen, and testosterone that convey information from remote outposts like the thyroid and endocrine glands. Still other messages arrive by telegraph from the brain or from regional centers in a process called paracrine signaling. Finally, cells communicate directly with their neighbors to make sure their actions are coordinated. What is perhaps most remarkable is that it is all just random, frantic action, a sequence of endless encounters directed by nothing more than elemental rules of attraction and repulsion. There is clearly no thinking presence behind any of the actions of the cells. It all just happens, smoothly and repeatedly, and so reliably that seldom are we even conscious of it. Yet somehow, all this produces not just order within the cell, but a perfect harmony right across the organism. In ways that we have barely begun to understand, trillions upon trillions of reflexive chemical reactions add up to a mobile, thinking, decision-making you. Or, come to that, a rather less reflective but still incredibly organized dung beetle. Every living thing, never forget, is a wonder of atomic engineering. Indeed, some organisms that we think of as primitive enjoy a level of cellular organization that makes our own look carelessly pedestrian. Disassemble the cells of a sponge, by passing them through a sieve, for instance, then dump them into a solution and they will find their way back together and build themselves into a sponge again. You can do this to them over and over, and they will doggedly reassemble because, like you and me and every other living thing, they have one overwhelming impulse to continue to be. And that's because of a curious, determined, barely understood molecule that is itself not alive and, for the most part, doesn't do anything at all. We call it DNA, and to begin to understand its supreme importance to science and to us, we need to go back 160 years or so to Victorian England and to the moment when the naturalist Charles Darwin had what has been called the single best idea that anyone has ever had. And then, for reasons that take a little explaining, locked it away in a drawer for the next 15 years. 25. Darwin's Singular Notion. In the late summer, or early autumn of 1859, Whitwell Elwin, editor of the respected British journal The Quarterly Review, was sent an advance copy of a new book by the naturalist Charles Darwin. Elwin read the book with interest and agreed that it had merit, but feared that the subject matter was too narrow to attract a wide audience. He urged Darwin to write a book about pigeons instead. "Everyone is interested in pigeons," he observed helpfully. Elwin's sage advice was ignored, and On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection or the Preservation of Favoured Races in the Struggle for Life was published in late November 1859, priced at 15 shillings. The first edition of 1,250 copies sold out on the first day. It has never been out of print, and scarcely out of controversy in all the time since. Not bad going for a man whose principal other interest was earthworms, and who, but for a single impetuous decision to sail around the world, would very probably have passed his life as an anonymous country parson, known for, well, for an interest in earthworms. Charles Robert Darwin was born on February the 12th, 1809, an auspicious date in history, on the same day in Kentucky Abraham Lincoln was born, in Shrewsbury, a sedate market town in the West Midlands of England. His father was a prosperous and well-regarded physician. His mother, who died when Charles was only 8, was the daughter of Josiah Wedgwood of pottery fame. Darwin enjoyed every advantage of upbringing, but continually pained his widowed father with his lackluster academic performance. "You care for nothing but shooting, dogs, and rat-catching, and you will be a disgrace to yourself and all your family," his father wrote in a line that nearly always appears just about here in any review of Darwin's early life. Although his inclination was to natural history, for his father's sake he tried to study medicine at Edinburgh University, but couldn't bear the blood and suffering. The experience of witnessing an operation on an understandably distressed child—this was in the days before anaesthetics, of course—left him permanently traumatized. He tried law instead, but found that insupportably dull, and finally managed, more or less by default, to acquire a degree in divinity from Cambridge. A life in a rural vicarage seemed to await him, when from out of the blue there came a more tempting offer. Darwin was invited to sail on the naval survey ship HMS Beagle, essentially as dinner company for the captain, Robert Fitzroy, whose rank precluded his socializing with anyone other than a gentleman. Fitzroy, who was very odd, chose Darwin in part because he liked the shape of Darwin's nose. It betokened depth of character, he believed. Darwin was not Fitzroy's first choice, but got the nod when Fitzroy's preferred companion dropped out. From a 21st-century perspective, the two men's most striking joint feature was their extreme youthfulness. At the time of sailing, Fitzroy was only 23, Darwin just 22. Fitzroy's formal assignment was to chart coastal waters, but his hobby, passion really, was to seek out evidence for a literal, biblical interpretation of creation. That Darwin was trained for the ministry was central to Fitzroy's decision to have him aboard. That Darwin subsequently proved to be not only liberal of view, but less than wholeheartedly devoted to Christian fundamentals, became a source of lasting friction between them. Darwin's time aboard HMS Beagle from 1831 to 1836 was obviously the formative experience of his life, but also one of the most trying. He and his captain shared a small cabin, which can't have been easy as Fitzroy was subject to fits of fury followed by spells of simmering resentment. He and Darwin constantly engaged in quarrels, some bordering on insanity, as Darwin later recalled. Ocean voyages tended to become melancholy undertakings at the best of times. The previous captain of the Beagle had put a bullet through his brain during a moment of lonely gloom, and Fitzroy came from a family well known for a depressive instinct. His uncle, Viscount Castlereagh, had slit his throat the previous decade while serving as Chancellor of the Exchequer. Fitzroy would himself commit suicide by the same method in 1865. Even in his calmer moods, Fitzroy proved strangely unknowable. Darwin was astounded to learn upon the conclusion of their voyage that almost at once Fitzroy married a young woman to whom he had long been betrothed. In 5 years in Darwin's company, he had not once hinted at an attachment, or even mentioned her name. In every other respect, however, the Beagle voyage was a triumph. Darwin experienced adventure enough to last a lifetime, and accumulated a hoard of specimens sufficient to make his reputation and keep him occupied for years. He found a magnificent trove of giant ancient fossils, including the finest megatherium known to date, survived a lethal earthquake in Chile, discovered a new species of dolphin, which he dutifully named Delphinus Fitzroyi, conducted diligent and useful geological investigations throughout the Andes, and developed a new and much-admired theory for the formation of coral atolls, which suggested, not coincidentally, that atolls could not form in less than 1 million years, the first hint of his long-standing attachment to the extreme antiquity of earthly processes. In 1836, aged 27, he returned home after being away for 5 years and 2 days. He never left England again. One thing Darwin didn't do on the voyage was propound the theory, or even a theory, of evolution. For a start, evolution as a concept was already decades old by the 1830s. Darwin's own grandfather, Erasmus, had paid tribute to evolutionary principles in a poem of inspired mediocrity called The Temple of Nature, years before Charles was even born. It wasn't until the younger Darwin was back in England and read Thomas Malthus's Essay on the Principle of Population, which proposed that increases in food supply could never keep up with population growth for mathematical reasons, that the idea began to percolate through his mind that life is a perpetual struggle, and that natural selection was the means by which some species prospered while others failed. Specifically, what Darwin saw was that all organisms competed for resources, and those that had some innate advantage would prosper and pass on that advantage to their offspring. By such means would species continuously improve. It seems an awfully simple idea. It is an awfully simple idea, but it explained a great deal, and Darwin was prepared to devote his life to it. "How stupid of me not to have thought of it," T.H. Huxley cried upon reading On the Origin of Species. "It is a view that has been echoed ever since." Interestingly, Darwin didn't use the phrase survival of the fittest in any of his work, though he did express his admiration for it. The expression was coined 5 years after the publication of On the Origin of Species by Herbert Spencer in Principles of Biology in 1864. Nor did he employ the word evolution in print until the 6th edition of Origin, by which time its use had become too widespread to resist, preferring instead descent with modification. Nor, above all, were his conclusions in any way inspired by his noticing, during his time in the Galapagos Islands, an interesting diversity in the beaks of finches. The story, as conventionally told, or at least as frequently remembered by many of us, is that Darwin, while travelling from island to island, noticed that the finches' beaks on each island were marvellously adapted for exploiting local resources, that on one island beaks were sturdy and short and good for cracking nuts, while on the next island beaks were perhaps long and thin and well suited for winkling food out of crevices, and it was this that set him to thinking that perhaps the birds had not been created this way, but had in a sense created themselves. In fact, the birds had created themselves, but it wasn't Darwin who noticed it. At the time of the Beagle voyage, Darwin was fresh out of college and not yet an accomplished naturalist, and so failed to see that the Galapagos birds were all of a type. It was his friend, the ornithologist John Gould, who realized that what Darwin had found was lots of finches with different talents. Unfortunately, in his inexperience, Darwin had not noted which birds came from which islands. He had made a similar error with tortoises. It took years to sort the muddles out. Because of these oversights and the need to sort through crates and crates of other beagle specimens, it wasn't until 1842, 6 years after his return to England, that Darwin finally began to sketch out the rudiments of his new theory. These he expanded into a 230-page sketch 2 years later. And then he did an extraordinary thing. He put his notes away and for the next decade and a half busied himself with other matters. He fathered 10 children, devoted nearly 8 years to writing an exhaustive opus on barnacles. "I hate a barnacle as no man ever did before," he sighed understandably upon the work's conclusion, and fell prey to strange disorders that left him chronically listless, faint, and flurried, as he put it. The symptoms nearly always included a terrible nausea, and generally also incorporated palpitations, migraines, exhaustion, trembling, spots before the eyes, shortness of breath, swimming of the head, and, not surprisingly, depression. The cause of the illness has never been established, but the most romantic and perhaps likely of the many suggested possibilities is that he suffered from Chagas' disease, a lingering tropical malady that he could have acquired from the bite of a benchuga bug in South America. A more prosaic explanation is that his condition was psychosomatic. In either case, the misery was not. Often he could work for no more than 20 minutes at a stretch, sometimes not that. Much of the rest of his time was devoted to a series of increasingly desperate treatments, icy plunge baths, dowsings in vinegar, draping himself with electric chains that subjected him to small jolts of current. He became something of a hermit, seldom leaving his home in Kent, Down House. One of his first acts upon moving to the house was to erect a mirror outside his study window so that he could identify and, if necessary, avoid callers. Darwin kept his theory to himself, because he well knew the storm it would cause. In 1844, the year he locked his notes away, a book called Vestiges of the Natural History of Creation roused much of the thinking world to fury by suggesting that humans might have evolved from lesser primates without the assistance of a divine creator. Anticipating the outcry, the author had taken careful steps to conceal his identity, which he kept a secret from even his closest friends for the next 40 years. Some wondered if Darwin himself might be the author. Others suspected Prince Albert. In fact, the author was a successful and generally unassuming Scottish publisher named Robert Chambers, whose reluctance to reveal himself had a practical dimension as well as a personal one. His firm was a leading publisher of Bibles. Vestiges was warmly blasted from pulpits throughout Britain and far beyond, but also attracted a good deal of more scholarly ire. The Edinburgh Review devoted nearly an entire issue, 85 pages, to pulling it to pieces. Even T.H. Huxley, a believer in evolution, attacked the book with some venom, unaware that the author was a friend. Darwin was one of the few to guess correctly. He happened to be visiting Chambers one day when an advance copy of the 6th edition of Vestiges was delivered. The keenness with which Chambers checked the revisions was something of a giveaway, though it appears the two men did not discuss it. Darwin's manuscript might have remained locked away till his death, but for an alarming blow that arrived from the Far East in the early summer of 1858, in the form of a packet containing a friendly letter from a young naturalist named Alfred Russel Wallace, and the draft of a paper, on the tendency of varieties to depart indefinitely from the original type, outlining a theory of natural selection that was uncannily similar to Darwin's secret jottings. Even some of the phrasing echoed Darwin's own. "I never saw a more striking coincidence," Darwin reflected in dismay. "If Wallace had my manuscript sketch written out in 1842, he could not have made a better short abstract." Wallace didn't drop into Darwin's life quite as unexpectedly as is sometimes suggested. The two were already corresponding, and Wallace had more than once generously sent Darwin specimens that he thought might be of interest. In the process of these exchanges, Darwin had discreetly warned Wallace that he regarded the subject of species creation as his own territory. "This summer will make the 20th year since I opened my first notebook on the question of how and in what way do species and varieties differ from each other," he had written to Wallace some time earlier. "I am now preparing my work for publication." he added, even though he wasn't really. In any case, Wallace failed to grasp what Darwin was trying to tell him, and of course he could have no idea that his own theory was so nearly identical to one that Darwin had been evolving, as it were, for 2 decades. Darwin was placed in an agonizing quandary. If he rushed into print to preserve his priority, he would be taking advantage of an innocent tip-off from a distant admirer. But if he stepped aside, as gentlemanly conduct arguably required, he would lose credit for a theory that he had independently propounded. Wallace's theory was, by Wallace's own admission, the result of a flash of insight. Darwin's was the product of years of careful, plodding, methodical thought. It was all crushingly unfair. To compound his misery, Darwin's youngest son, also named Charles, had contracted scarlet fever and was critically ill. At the height of the crisis, on June the 28th, the child died. Despite the distraction of his son's illness, Darwin found time to dash off letters to his friends, Charles Lyell and Joseph Hooker, offering to step aside, but noting that to do so would mean that all his work, whatever it may amount to, will be smashed. Lyell and Hooker came up with a compromise solution of presenting a summary of Darwin's and Wallace's ideas together. The venue they settled on was a meeting of the Linnaean Society, which at the time was struggling to find its way back into fashion as a seat of scientific eminence. On July the 1st, 1858, Darwin's and Wallace's theory was unveiled to the world. Darwin himself was not present. On the day of the meeting, he and his wife were burying their son. The Darwin-Wallace presentation was one of 7 that evening. One of the others was on the flora of Angola, and if the 30 or so people in the audience had any idea that they were witnessing the scientific highlight of the century, they showed no sign of it. No discussion followed, nor did the event attract much notice elsewhere. Darwin cheerfully later noted that only one person, a Professor Horton of Dublin, mentioned the 2 papers in print, and his conclusion was that all that was new in them was false, and what was true was old. Wallace, still in the distant East, learned of these manoeuvrings long after the event, but was remarkably equable and seemed pleased to have been included at all. He even referred to the theory forever after as Darwinism. Much less amenable to Darwin's claim of priority was a Scottish gardener named Patrick Matthew, who had, rather remarkably, also come up with the principles of natural selection, in fact in the very year that Darwin had set sail in the Beagle. Unfortunately, Matthew had published these views in a book called Naval Timber and Arboriculture, which had been missed not just by Darwin but by the entire world. Matthew kicked up in a lively manner with a letter to Gardner's Chronicle when he saw Darwin gaining credit everywhere for an idea that really was his. Darwin apologized without hesitation, though he did note for the record, "I think that no one will feel surprised that neither I, nor apparently any other naturalist, has heard of Mr. Matthew's views, considering how briefly they are given, and they appeared in the appendix to a work on naval timber and arboriculture." Wallace continued for another 50 years as a naturalist and thinker, occasionally a very good one, but increasingly fell from scientific favour by taking up dubious interests such as spiritualism and the possibility of life existing elsewhere in the universe. So the theory became, essentially by default, Darwin's alone. Darwin never ceased being tormented by his ideas. He referred to himself as the devil's chaplain, and said that revealing the theory felt like confessing a murder. Apart from all else, he knew it deeply pained his beloved and pious wife. Even so, he set to work at once expanding his manuscript into a book-length work. Provisionally, he called it An Abstract of an Essay on the Origin of Species and Varieties Through Natural Selection, a title so tepid and tentative that his publisher, John Murray, decided to issue just 500 copies. But once presented with a manuscript and a slightly more arresting title, Murray reconsidered and increased the initial print run to 1,250. On the Origin of Species was an immediate commercial success, but rather less of a critical one. Darwin's theory presented 2 intractable difficulties. It needed far more time than Lord Kelvin was willing to concede, and it was scarcely supported by fossil evidence. Where, asked Darwin's more thoughtful critics, were the transitional forms that his theory so clearly called for? If new species were continuously evolving, then there ought to be lots of intermediate forms scattered across the fossil record. But there were not. In fact, the record as it existed then, and for a long time afterward, showed no life at all right up to the moment of the famous Cambrian explosion. By coincidence, in 1861, at the height of the controversy, just such evidence turned up when workers in Bavaria found the bones of an ancient Archaeopteryx, a creature halfway between a bird and a dinosaur. It had feathers, but it also had teeth. It was an impressive and helpful find, and its significance much debated, but a single discovery could hardly be considered conclusive. But now, here was Darwin, without any evidence, insisting that the earlier seas must have had abundant life, and that we just hadn't found it yet, because, for whatever reason, it hadn't been preserved. It simply could not be otherwise, Darwin maintained. The case at present must remain inexplicable, and may be truly urged as a valid argument against the views here entertained, he allowed most candidly, but he refused to entertain an alternative possibility. By way of explanation, he speculated, inventively but incorrectly, that perhaps the pre-Cambrian seas had been too clear to lay down sediments, and thus had preserved no fossils. Even Darwin's closest friends were troubled by the blitheness of some of his assertions. Adam Sedgwick, who had taught Darwin at Cambridge and taken him on a geological tour of Wales in 1831, said the book gave him more pain than pleasure. Louis Agassiz dismissed it as poor conjecture. Even Lyell concluded gloomily, "Darwin goes too far." T.H. Huxley disliked Darwin's insistence on huge amounts of geological time, because he was a saltationist, which is to say, a believer in the idea that evolutionary changes happen not gradually, but suddenly. Saltationists, the word comes from the Latin for leap, couldn't accept that complicated organs could ever emerge in slow stages. What good, after all, is one-tenth of a wing, or half an eye? Such organs, they thought, only made sense if they appeared in a finished state. The belief was surprising in as radical a spirit as Huxley, because it closely recalled a very conservative religious notion first put forward by the English theologian William Paley in 1802, and known as argument from design. Paley contended that if you found a pocket watch on the ground, even if you had never seen such a thing before, you would instantly perceive that it had been made by an intelligent entity. So it was, he believed, with nature. Its complexity was proof of its design. The notion was a powerful one in the 19th century, and it gave Darwin trouble too. "The eye to this day gives me a cold shudder," he acknowledged in a letter to a friend. In The Origin he conceded that it seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest possible degree that natural selection could produce such an instrument in gradual steps. Even so, and to the unending exasperation of his supporters, Darwin not only insisted that all change was gradual, but in nearly every edition of Origin he stepped up the amount of time he supposed necessary to allow evolution to progress, which pushed his ideas increasingly out of favour. Eventually, according to the scientist and historian Geoffrey Schwartz, Darwin lost virtually all the support that still remained among the ranks of fellow natural historians and geologists. Ironically, considering that Darwin called his book On the Origin of Species, the one thing he couldn't explain was how species originated. Darwin's theory suggested a mechanism for how a species might become stronger, or better, or faster, in a word, fitter, but gave no indication of how it might throw up a new species. A Scottish engineer, Fleming Jenkin, considered the problem and noted an important flaw in Darwin's argument. Darwin believed that any beneficial trait that arose in one generation would be passed on to subsequent generations, thus strengthening the species. Jenkin pointed out that a favourable trait in one parent wouldn't become dominant in succeeding generations, but in fact would be diluted through blending. If you pour whiskey into a tumbler of water, you don't make the whiskey stronger, you make it weaker. And if you pour that dilute solution into another glass of water, it becomes weaker still. In the same way, any favourable trait introduced by one parent would be successively watered down by subsequent matings until it ceased to be apparent at all. Thus, Darwin's theory was not a recipe for change, but for constancy. Lucky flukes might arise from time to time, but they would soon vanish under the general impulse to bring everything back to a stable mediocrity. If natural selection were to work, some alternative, unconsidered mechanism was required. Unknown to Darwin and everyone else, 800 miles away, in a tranquil corner of Middle Europe, a retiring monk named Gregor Mendel was coming up with a solution. Mendel was born in 1822 to a humble farming family in a backwater of the Austrian Empire in what is now the Czech Republic. Schoolbooks once portrayed him as a simple but observant provincial monk, whose discoveries were largely serendipitous, the result of noticing some interesting traits of inheritance while pottering about with pea plants in the monastery's kitchen garden. In fact, Mendel was a trained scientist. He had studied physics and mathematics at the Olmütz Philosophical Institute and the University of Vienna, and he brought scientific discipline to all he did. Moreover, the monastery at Brno, where he lived from 1843, was known as a learned institution. It had a library of 20,000 books and a tradition of careful scientific investigation. Before embarking on his experiments, Mendel spent 2 years preparing his control specimens, 7 varieties of pea, to make sure they bred true. Then, helped by 2 full-time assistants, he repeatedly bred and crossbred hybrids from 30,000 pea plants. It was delicate work, requiring them to take the most exacting pains to avoid accidental cross-fertilization and to note every slight variation in the growth and appearance of seeds, pods, leaves, stems, and flowers. Mendel knew what he was doing. He never used the word gene. It wasn't coined until 1913 in an English medical dictionary, though he did invent the terms dominant and recessive. What he established was that every seed contained 2 factors, or elementi, as he called them, a dominant one and a recessive one, and these factors, when combined, produced predictable patterns of inheritance. The results he converted into precise mathematical formulae. Altogether, Mendel spent 8 years on the experiments, then confirmed his results with similar experiments on flowers, corn, and other plants. If anything, Mendel was too scientific in his approach, for when he presented his findings at the February and March meetings of the Natural History Society of Brno in 1865, the audience of about 40 listened politely, but was conspicuously unmoved, even though the breeding of plants was a matter of great practical interest to many of the members. When Mendel's report was published, he eagerly sent a copy to the great Swiss botanist Carl Wilhelm von Negli, whose support was more or less vital for the theory's prospects. Unfortunately, Negli failed to perceive the importance of what Mendel had found. He suggested that Mendel try breeding hawkweed. Mendel obediently did as Negli suggested, but quickly realized that hawkweed had none of the requisite features for studying heritability. It was evident to him that Negli had not read the paper closely, or possibly at all. Frustrated, Mendel retired from investigating heritability and spent the rest of his life growing outstanding vegetables and studying bees, mice, and sunspots, among much else. Eventually, he was made abbot. Mendel's findings weren't quite as widely ignored as is sometimes suggested. His study received a glowing entry in the Encyclopaedia Britannica, then a more leading record of scientific thought than now, and was cited repeatedly in an important paper by the German Wilhelm Ulbis Focke. Indeed, it was because Mendel's ideas never entirely sank below the waterline of scientific thought that they were so easily recovered when the world was ready for them. Together, without realizing it, Darwin and Mendel laid the groundwork for all of life sciences in the 20th century. Darwin saw that all living things are connected, that ultimately they trace their ancestry to a single common source, while Mendel's work provided the mechanism to explain how that could happen. The two men could easily have helped each other. Mendel owned a German edition of The Origin of Species, which he is known to have read, so he must have realized the applicability of his work to Darwin's, yet he appears to have made no effort to get in touch. And Darwin, for his part, is known to have studied Focke's influential paper with its repeated references to Mendel's work, but didn't connect them to his own studies. The one thing everyone thinks featured in Darwin's argument, that humans are descended from apes, didn't feature at all, except as one passing allusion. Even so, it took no great leap of imagination to see the implications for human development in Darwin's theories, and it became an immediate talking point. The showdown came on